We're listening to baritone Thomas Hampson singing a simple song by Leonard Bernstein. It's a selection on Mr. Hampson's new CD, Wondrous Free, Song of America II, which is a collection of pieces composed by Americans, both famous and obscure, between 1759 and 1982. Mr. Hampson's singing career, which has been a bit briefer, spanning 25 years, has taken him to the world's finest opera houses and concert halls. He's won many honors for the 150 albums he has released, including a Grammy and two Edison Prizes. And currently, Mr. Hampson is serving as the first Mary and James G. Wallach Artist in Residence at the New York Philharmonic, as well as the Leonard Bernstein Scholar in Residence. He'll be performing Mozart's Prague Symphony with the New York Philharmonic tomorrow night. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
Scholar. A scholar as well. You've been an artist. You've been all sorts of other things. Now are you officially a scholar?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's pretty official when the New York Philharmonic asks you to take on that title. But I think it just folded over a lot of things I'm doing with the New York Phil this season as artist in residence and doing the symposia and some scholarly activities. And they have this wonderful position that probably will fold in all together, and it will be one position.
What about Wondrous Free, second segment, I guess, of the largest Song of America project? Does that also fold in, or is that just separate?
No, not really. That's really lives on its own. I've been very involved in the Song of America project for the last 4 or 5 years with a couple of tours, and this is the second tour, and it probably scares everybody to hear Song of America Volume 2, because clearly Volume 3 is on the way and Volume 6 is hoped for and all that kind of thing. But the point
is, we are a big country. We've had a lot of composers.
Exactly. A lot of songs to sing. But the whole project is in cooperation with the Library of Congress, and it's essentially looking at the history of American culture through the eyes of our poets and the ears of our composers.
Well, you're known for your interpretations of German romantic song. So how is singing Schubert or Schumann or Mahler different from singing John Duke?
Well, different is always what you're singing, and different is always the context, which would be the language or even perhaps the mode of expression. A German Lied has a different structure than perhaps a 20th century American song, but essentially it's all a narration of that particular psychology, what the poem is about, where the people are coming from. And in a lot of ways, song is the most intimate storytelling of personal lives. It's what Copland called composers telling you what it's like to be alive now.
And you categorize your efforts as art song. Now, art song can be pretty all-embracing.
That's a very good point. In fact, there's a new movement amongst many musicians to actually try and call it classic song.
Means not rock and roll.
Meaning it's not rock and roll. It's also the biggest difference, quite frankly, is that it's based on poetry. It is poetry set to music. It is two essential art forms, or at least forms of art that come out of two different languages, music as a language and literary language. And the two go into conversation and become a song. It's not lyric writing, it's not pop writing, it's not jazz, it's not another popular idiom. It is really a concentration of those two expressions exploring metaphor.
But that would include jazz, and it would include blues, because blues can sometimes really be quite poetic, or can include religious music, hymns and gospel songs, can't it?
Yes, and your point's well taken, except that poetic as an adjective is precisely the point. It is poetry set to music. And, you know, and that is the similarity to German Lieder. In fact, some of this project started really with a question that is always asked: who's our Schubert? Who's our Brahms? Who's our Tchaikovsky? And so forth and so on. And that question is probably not the right question to ask. It's probably better to look at the creative evidence of our culture over the last couple of hundred years in 10 and 15-year periods of time, and let those composers and poets tell us about that, rather than trying to find a comparison to the quote-unquote classic world.
Wasn't Volume 1 of Song of America pretty all Walt Whitman poems?
No, that was actually even yet another separate album called The World of Walt Whitman, different composers on texts of Walt Whitman. The first volume, I suppose you would call, really was Old Song Resung, which was several years ago, and just went out and got all those wonderful songs that we heard, especially in the 20th century, on the radio, and brought them back to life. And whether that be some folk songs like Shenandoah or Cadman songs, and also Duke was on there as well. And then when we actually did the tour in 2005-06, we took the Stephen Foster record, all these were Angel EMI, and the Walt Whitman record, and the Old Song Resung. We made a compilation of that, and we called that Song of America.
Well, of course, Walt Whitman had a famous poem, Song of Myself.
Yes, and he also has the famous song, the famous poem called I Hear America Singing. And that was actually the one of the thrusts of the initial projects I did, PBS and in Salzburg as well. The Song of America became a new title with the introduction of the Library of Congress as a real power and resource to this whole project. Them wanting to actually call part of their website for the music division I Hear America Singing, which I said, terrific, then let's just focus on something called song. And then we went back and forth of song in America, song of America, song around America, song from America, all those things, and landed on Song of America, which made a lot of sense.
How did the American song tradition start? When we look at the American arts in general, the early days, they were all kind of watered-down versions of European art.
Well, I think that's a very valid point. Francis Hopkinson, which we're celebrating 250 years of when he sent some songs, including My Days Have Been So Wondrous Free, to George Washington and said, I believe these are the first songs or first musical creations on American soil by an American sort of thing. What do you think? I had this romantic idea that, George and Francis would have some rather esoteric conversation about arts. Turns out George writes back and says, I've got my hands full here on the Potomac. Thanks for your mail. I'll take your word for it. I'm very proud of you. Wouldn't know, can't carry a tune. Goodbye. And it's very sweet. And they were very close friends. And the more important part of that communication really is Francis Hopkinson saying, I hope that my modest efforts here are the beginning of the flourishing of arts and humanities in the United States.
But was there a time when American composers started thinking about coming up with something that was particularly American?
Without question. It goes right to the heart of Emerson's challenge when Ralph Waldo Emerson said to everybody, look, stop copying. Let what you're trying to say dictate how you say it. And, of course, he found his greatest disciple in that in Walt Whitman. Of course, Walt had other things to say than perhaps what Ralph wanted to really hear, so that relationship became slightly more strained later in the years. But in fact, yes, about the middle of the 19th century, we see a very demonstrable effort to say, this is how we're going to do things over here, not just in defensiveness of European models, but there's a different way to say things. There's different things that need to be said. Having said all of that, probably Stephen Foster starts that ball rolling, but the real first clashing, clanging voice was certainly Charles Ives.
Well, Stephen Foster sounds like he was thinking about American folk traditions as inspiration for much of his work.
Yes, I think he was.
Different than Charles Ives.
I think he was very in tune with what we call folk. In other words, people and their passions and their compassions. I think his biggest model was definitely Thomas More and the Irish Melodies, which was hugely popular on both sides of the Atlantic through most of the 19th century. Charles Ives also had an eye towards the folk, as it were, or his people, but it was a little bit more like having contrary bands marching towards one another kind of thing. And there's a lot of similarities. He loved Stephen Foster, but he was really trying to say perhaps something different.
Well, you mentioned the bands marching toward each other. I've always found that fascinating. Charles Ives as an American original. His father, if I remember correctly, was a musician.
Yes.
And he had this experience when he was a kid where he was in the church steeple, perhaps, And these two marching bands on Independence Day came from opposite directions, and he heard the two, and that inspired him to think along those lines.
Oh, his father was his most enormous influence in his life, George, and he was an amazing musician. And they would do these kinds of experiments. The other one that I found even more enlightening was playing the accompaniment of the Star Spangled Banner in one key, and him and Charlie having to sing it in another. This was, ultimate ear training. It was quite fun.
So would you say that Charles Ives really is the first great American composer?
No, I would say he was the first unique voice, one that took us many decades to understand. And I think it would be a mistake to land all of our eggs in that basket. We had some marvelous composers, and I also am maybe even slightly defensive. I think because composers sounded like other composers or spoke of their times, if H.H. Beach, which was an extraordinary story in of itself, was a woman composing in Boston, sounded like Brahms, I fail to see what the problem is. Edward McDowell was probably the most recognized first international American composer. Franz Liszt thought his music was absolutely wonderful. Charles Griffiths was writing songs in German poetry in German. By the way, McDowell, Griffiths, and Ives all spoke fluent German, especially Ives, especially Griffiths. And he was composing songs that were much to be compared with the songs of Hugo Wolf. So I think the interchange is what's interesting to me. And yes, we can identify unique things that become this soil's progeny, but I think we would make a mistake to try and find some line of demarcation.
Well, what I find interesting is that Charles Ives couldn't make a living as a composer, and he, like the great American poet Wallace Stevens, had a day job, despite their importance in their fields, because America still wasn't ready, perhaps.
Well, Maybe there's another story in there. Maybe there's a story of the effort of private lives. Maybe there's the effort of creativity that has nothing to do with making money. Maybe there's the need to compose as well as the need to live, and they were happily separate things. Actually, the 19th century to the 20th century had in several cultures had many. I mean, Rilke worked quite some time as some sort of functionary in the post office or something, and still wrote some of the most beautiful poetry of the turn of the century. So that's just one example. I think that we're better off studying what it meant to be alive and creative than we are to perhaps define it in just raw economic terms.
My guest is Thomas Hampson, whose latest CD is Wondrous Free, Songs of America 2. Meanwhile, you're also the first artist in residence, the first for the New York Philharmonic. What does that entail?
Well, it came out of the blue to me as well. It was a phone call from Alan Gilbert, who is the new music director, who just simply wanted a new kind of structure in his tenure. He's collected quite a team of composers and advisors and musicians, colleagues, had formed a new chamber group, a new music group, and one of the ideas was to simply hand somebody the possibility of exploiting and exposing all the different ideas of music and the ways they perform. And that he invited a singer is perhaps his own fault, but we've got orchestral things, we've got a lot of 20th century and some 21st century music, a commission piece, I'm doing a recital. The idea for the symposia to somehow, because Alan and I talked, and he said, what can I do as a singer that will be somehow augmenting for people's perception of what we do as musicians? And clearly the relationship of word and music is a very volatile and very complex relationship. And so I'm trying in three public lectures to expose essentially the dialogue of music and language searching for a common metaphor of the human experience. That's what it's all the thrust of.
So you'll be giving lectures, but you'll also be performing with the orchestra.
Right. Well, in fact, last Monday I gave the first one, which was a kind of setting up this premise, and we went deeply through the world of Zemlinsky and Tagore. In fact, what I'm singing with
Tagore,
the symphony,
the great Indian writer.
The Rabindranath Tagore, the Nobel Literature Prize winner 1913, is the poetic source of Alexander Zemlinsky's forgotten masterpiece or seldom played masterpiece, the Lyric Symphony, which is actually what I do on the program. The program starts with Beethoven Prometheus Overture and then the Prague Symphony of Mozart, and the second half is Alexander Zemlinsky's Lyric Symphony on texts by Tagore.
Now, you were a protege of Leonard Bernstein, so I guess I shouldn't be surprised you also named the Bernstein Scholar in Residence.
I have to stop you right there.
You weren't?
Yes, but I have such deep, humble admiration for Leonard Bernstein that I think anything we call anything Leonard Bernstein after Leonard Bernstein, we should do very, very carefully and quietly. This was an extraordinary human being, a major impact on the arts and the appreciation of education and education of arts in America, and I'm very honored to be that. I did, in Lenny's last 4 years of life, sing with him quite often. I met him and sang for him in 1986, and until his death was very involved in projects, and he was extraordinarily good to me.
And we opened with A Simple Song,
yes,
by Leonard Bernstein. And now, he wrote so many great songs.
Wonderful songs.
What leads you to choose this one of all?
Well, you know, in all of the works that I've sung of Lenny's and even had the fortune to record, there always seems to be one song in each piece that seems to be just pure Lenny. And I've always felt Simple Song was just completely Lenny. I think from his arias and barcaroles, that wonderful duet with the violin, baritone of the violin at the Jewish wedding, is just so incredibly Lenny. You have to wonder with On the Town whether Lucky to Be Me, or certainly Lonely Town, you know, if that isn't just totally Lenny. So there's all these Lenny moments, and the Simple Song, I've always found an extremely beautiful, humble, spiritual statement by Leonard Bernstein. I'm very glad to sing it.
And a number of these songs have a spiritual side.
Well, Lenny was deeply spiritual.
Yeah, but this wasn't written for any of his larger pieces.
The Simple Song comes out of the Mass. It was, actually. It was the opening celebrant's opening aria in the Mass. And that's actually where I learned it. When the Mass was new in the late 70s, I was still in high school or just coming into college, and was actually part of a big project where even Michael Hume came out and sang the celebrant, and I was the understudy. And that's where I sang the song. And I sang it and sang it and sang it all over, because everybody was just crazy about the song. Then it wasn't performed very much, and the theater piece Mass hasn't had that many revivals in the last, say, 10 years. Which I think we're very due for. It's a very timely piece, and I think Lenny's creation would be well re-looked at.
Well, who wrote the lyric? Because
Stephen Schwartz.
So we are talking about this.
The Simple Song is actually based on Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
It is the Lauda Dei is a sort of a, if you will, a personalization of the Laudate. Or Laudatumus, but the Simple Song, the title is our creation, but the text, I will sing the Lord a simple song, is us. But then he goes through the 23rd Psalm.
Because you said earlier that a key factor in your decision of which songs to pick and which ones you would not was the poetry side, and I wonder whether it has to be a perfect merging, or is sometimes the poetry more important, because as a singer, the words do matter an awful lot.
The Wondrous Free album is and the project Song of America is very much structured on the premise of poetry set to music. The Wondrous Free album as an album perhaps leaks on a few edges, not too many, and one of them is the 90th birthday celebration of Leonard Bernstein and a song that I've sang for many, many years but had never recorded. So that's why actually Simple Song is on there. Lenny did set other songs that are poetry, in fact, Rilke poetry, but
certain poets do lend themselves better to being sung than others.
Yes.
Walt Whitman seems to be very good because of the certain way that he, I guess,
changed fundamentally the use of language and the use of poetic language and expression, and gave it a through-flowing, non-metered structure, which of course was just a blessing to composers. So that is a paramount example. But I think that some poets sing easier than others. What is important, and what I love about this conversation, is that we're really talking about what happens when poetry is set to music, and it transcends the structure of the poet. It is not about a musical essence of that poem. It is about a joint conversation of a joint agenda or a joint goal in the expression of both idioms.
I was thinking about how Wallace Stevens and John Ashbery might not lend themselves as well to being set to music, great poets nonetheless, whereas Walt Whitman or William Carlos Williams or Rilke would.
Well,
and Rilke, there were so many great pieces of music written from his poetry.
I think that what impresses me is more the composer's relationship to the metaphor in the poetry rather than just the poetic structure. Some composers do well with different poetic languages and structures and rhythms that are inherent to the language, but most poetry, when set to music, is pretty much the victim of the rhythm of the composer, and that's why it is a separate art form. Curiously, you keep mentioning Wallace Stevens, which is one of my favorite poets, but he's been actually quite often set to music and quite beautifully because I think that his poetry is always about illuminating another recognition of our lives, and whether it be spiritual or a deeper understanding of everyday activities, whatever that may very well be in Wallace Stevens. And I think that's the stuff that composers really love.
You mentioned that this is volume two of a long-term project. Are you already at work on volume three?
Yes, I am, actually. The next volume will be very heavily centered on contemporary poets and contemporary composers, and especially composers that have set works for me, Richard Daniapour, Stephen Paulus, Michael Tilson Thomas, John Corigliano, and also either with that focus and album, or in addition to it, certainly one of our greatest composers, Samuel Barber, celebrating his 100th year anniversary this coming year, 2010.
When someone sets writes a piece of music for you, do they tend to think about your voice?
Oh, yes. Thank God.
Because I've heard of commissioned pieces where the person who commissioned them then looked at the piece, especially a violinist might look at it and say, oh, my God.
What am I going to do with that? There are wonderful stories of that through musical history, even in the 19th century. One of my favorite, actually, is Gustav Mahler, who loved this man, Friedrich Weidemann, and sends him the manuscripts of the Rückert song. He says, oh, I can hardly wait, and Um Mitternacht, oh, I just hear your voice all over it, and it's got high A's all over the place because it's all in A minor, or I have high B's, actually, and so that got all changed in the first performance. But no, I mean, Michael and Richard and John, I mean, they all know my voice. They know what kind of singer I am. They know that I'm essentially lyric. They know that I've got some low notes and some high notes. Probably the most conversations, well, no, Richard Daniapour and Michael and I have had a lot of conversations about what's comfortable. And then we talk about the texts. At some point, they'll say, look, I really want to set this poem. And then it's up to them. And then they do send me some once in a while unsingable things.
Thomas Hampson's latest CD is Wondrous Free, Song of America, Volume 2. He is also just starting off as the first Mary and James G. Wallach Artist in Residence at the New York Philharmonic, as well as the Leonard Bernstein Scholar in Residence. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with you again. And we're going to go out with a little Stephen Foster.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh,